CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
And he got to talk back to his dad and not get like get in trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
That's got to be cool. Yeah.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins from CinemaSins.
Hello, hello.
Today we have a very special guest. It's writer-director Seth Larney, who has done a movie called 2067. It's coming out on in theaters, on demand and digital on October 2nd. Seth, welcome.
Thanks so much, man. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for sharing your time and everything. I was wondering what your inspiration was for this project. It's basically about a world that's running out of oxygen, and some people have to travel through time to solve the problem. Yeah. But what was your inspiration for this movie?
Well, you know, I grew up in the forest in Australia as a kid. Like, I was a real bush kid, so to speak. So my summers were really just sort of climbing trees and swimming in. We have this incredible river that runs through our property in the bush, swimming in rivers and exploring caves. And then when I left that sort of place, and we grew up with no electricity, just really, really in the forest. And so when I left there and I moved to the city to work on movies, I always wanted to be a filmmaker, right, from when I was sort of like 5 or 6 years old.
Wow.
Obsessed with it. I used to read science fiction novels, anything I could get my hands on, to where this tiny little 7-inch black and white TV. I watched all the classic movies on that. I remember watching Predator and Alien and Gone with the Wind and, all this stuff. And then when I moved to the city to work on the Matrix sequels, were my first films. I heard this horrific stat, which was that the Amazon rainforest at that time, and we're talking 2002 or 2001, right, was being deforested at the rate of something like 3 football fields per minute. And the Amazon rainforest accounts for 20% of the world's breathable oxygen. And that just freaked me out, I just was like, the idea that, future generations aren't going to be blessed with having access to the same life that I had growing up as a kid, it just was sort of terrifying to me, right? And then meanwhile, I growing up, I loved all these classic sci-fi movies like 2001 and Soylent Green and Logan's Run and just these films that really talk about like these big philosophical questions. Is really kind of deeply thematically rooted, fun, exciting sci-fi genre films. And so, to me, and I'm a thriller director, I wanted to make a film that is in that vein, that is fun for people, because films, let's face it, films are for audiences. They need to be fun, That's why I love genre films. But as a filmmaker, for me, the biggest blessing you could possibly have is to be able to infuse that fun ride with a question that hopefully can live on in the audience, and if that could maybe affect someone's life in even the smallest way, then I think it's worth it for me. So yeah, that's really where the motivation comes from.
Yeah, and I was wondering how much like the Australian bushfires got caught into this. And of course, California is going through a lot of this too. It's weird because unless you live in those places, it feels like it doesn't feel like anybody really knows about this stuff a lot of times.
Right. It's real for other people. No, you guys have had a horrible time over there, and we did, a couple of years ago here as well. And, it's, so not to give too much away about the film, but there is this in the opening of the movie, there is a pretty big visual effects shot that is showing, the Amazon rainforest being burnt to the ground, and not just the Amazon, but half of the world, which attributes this apocalypse. And that was always in the script. And as I said, the Amazon rainforest and the trees were a big part of the motivation for the writing of the script. And so when we would, that shot was one of the last shots to come in when we were working on our visual effects. And I literally have, like, I've got three monitors in my office, and I had that visual effects shot that we're working on with this apocalyptic fire burning. And then on the monitor next to it, I had the fire radar, because my father's house and my mother's house were both being evacuated in the same couple of day period, and they're 300 miles apart from each other. That's how big the fires were across here. I mean, that was just one part of this much, much bigger front. And I was watching the fire, like, encroaching on my dad's property, kind of freaking out, you know, wondering whether he was going to be able to get out in time. You know, he doesn't have cell reception up there, so I couldn't get in contact with him. And I'm stressing out, thinking, do I have to get in the car and drive up into the fires to try and find him? You know, what do you do? And at the same time, doing these reviews for a visual effects shot for a movie about the same thing, it felt like just really surreal, you know, like terrifyingly serendipitous, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I love time travel movies, and I love when there is, you know, each time travel movie seems to have its own interpretation of how it would work and everything. I think this is the first time I've ever seen, and I don't know how, again, we don't want to spoil anything in this movie, but I don't think I've ever seen it quite done as it was in this one. If you want to talk about the various details of it, you may, for the audience, but what was your, I kind of wanted to know how you came up with your time travel rules.
Yeah, man. Cool. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll try not to talk about specific spoilers too much, but basically I think, like, as we were saying earlier, like off air, that, you know, time travel, there's so many great time travel movies that have been made, you know, in the past. I'm a huge fan of this genre. And I think like one of the challenges is doing something new and fresh that hasn't been done before. But also I think that the reason that they work when they do work, and I think this goes for all movies, is it's just so important to create a consistent logic, right? Because, you know, when you're dealing with these sorts of things, like, I'm a big science nerd as well, right? I love astronomy. I love physics. You know, there's no real definition of how time travel would work, because many physicists consider it to be a paradox. But I think that as long as you create a set of rules for your particular version of time travel, and you stick to those rules religiously, you know, that you never waver from those rules, you create a logic set that works for your universe, I think that's the way through trying to work out sort of like what would happen in every beat, you know. And the other thing for me that was really important, and I try and bring all choices that I make, whether it's visual effects choices, script logic choices, I try and reduce them always down to character. And what is the framework that you're using that is going to help you to tell the most compelling character journey that you can tell? Like, how are those choices going to serve your character arc rather than the other way around? Like, rather than the time travel logic dictating what happens to the character, what is this character journey I'm trying to tell? And those character choices, how are they challenged by the logic, by the time travel twists, right? So, like, another way of putting it is, like, this isn't a science fiction movie just because it's a science fiction movie. It's a science fiction movie because that's the only way I could tell this particular character story. And also this particular kind of like thematic as well. This, you know, the thematic is can we change things? Can we take control of our own destiny? You know, this, like, the way I phrase it sometimes, it's like fate versus faith, right? So do we succumb to a fatalistic attitude because, you know, the world's burning to the ground, right? We've got COVID-19 and it's hard, you know, it's hard to stop, you know, and it's affecting all of us. And do we just succumb to this kind of tidal wave, you know, or do we just really believe that if we make hard choices and choose to, and those hard choices might mean that we need to sacrifice for each other, right? That we need to do things that take us out of our comfort zone. But if we believe that we can make a difference, then maybe we can, right? So the time travel sort of like logic is really just designed in a way to challenge his character and really tap into his deepest fears as a character, which we all have as human beings, and hold him up to the light, so to speak, so that he's forced to evolve and forced to make those choices for himself. And then hopefully audience will sort of see the outcome and make their own decision for their own lives about that as well.
It's actually really interesting. I'm going to try to do this without giving anything away, but with the Ethan White character, though, because you also have this great hook, right? You have this mystery element where they get the message right at the beginning, you know, send Ethan White, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you have this great hook. But then when you find out what that's about, which it was one of those great moments where I'm like, you know, it surprised me, but I was also like, well, clearly it couldn't have really been anything else, which to me is, you know, to me is the moniker of a pretty great mystery. And, but then I also kind of wonder like how they knew, like how that message, like what if that message hadn't worked, you know, because I mean, there is that kind of battle he's having with whether or not he should go because of things going on in the present time for him. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was fascinating. Like when everything just kind of comes together, I really enjoyed that aspect of it.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I mean, there is a really big and deep philosophical conversation to be had around that topic, I think. And it is difficult to talk about in too much detail with that because it's like, you know, it's sort of like the film. But I think what it really comes down to at the end of the day is exactly what I was just sort of saying before. It comes down to, and I think, you know, what do you believe? And that belief becoming an important factor in the mechanics of things, you know, in like maybe your belief can affect your own reality. Maybe choice is actually the most powerful and potent factor in the equation, I guess. I think it's a topic you could talk about for hours, but it's hard to know how to get into it without sort of, you know, referencing plot points.
That's the thing, man. Like there was another movie involving time travel. I think it was called Volition. But, you know, you're sitting there going, I want to ask so many things about this time travel that's in this movie, but then I'm going to give away details of it and everything. And you really just should just figure it out for yourself and have fun with that, you know?
I think also something that's really important to me is like, I think it's really cool if you can watch a movie and say a certain audience member that may not necessarily be just a specific fan of time travel movies or science fiction movies even, you know, I want that sort of fan, audience member to be able to watch a film and hopefully just have a fun experience. And it may be even more than a fun experience. Maybe they watch it and go, wow, okay, that was fun and that was cool. And I kind of feel something at the end, you know, and that can be enough. Like maybe I just feel something about just the characters, you know, and I find that inspiring. But then there's a level down from that of an audience member, maybe like us, right, that are kind of more fans of the genre and who want to be challenged on different levels and are kind of up for that challenge and more active in the kind of digging into the thematic and the story and the mechanics and stuff. And for those people, I also wanted a film that they could watch it multiple times. And for the first few times that you watch it, hopefully you will see, knowing what happens, you'll see the precursors and the foreshadowing and the clues. And yeah, as you were saying earlier, you know, this is one of the cool things that you can do with time travel. It's like everything is kind of out there in the open. You know, that's something I love directors like M. Night, for instance, right? Like something that I really kind of like take away from his filmmaking that, you know, I think the biggest trick that you can play when you're making a mystery thriller is to play your cards out in the open, you know? You don't want to cheat the audience. You want to give the audience the reward that what you hope is that they're following and they're kind of like half a step behind, but they're picking it all up. They're taking it in. They're trying to put it together. But then when you get into the climax, it's just all it should take is this one key in the lock and a tiny little shift, a little click. And then everything comes into illumination and you realize, oh, I had all of that already, right? Like I saw all of those things, right? They were all there. They were all said, there's nothing hidden. There's no new information here, except maybe one little key thing that you didn't connect. And then it should hopefully become clear. That was really my goal, I think, from a kind of like fan of the genre sort of standpoint. I love that stuff.
Yeah. I was wondering. I'm always fascinated by the casting process. I had seen Cody Smith McPhee in a bunch of things before this. You know, most people probably know him as Nightcrawler in the latest X-Men movies.
Paranorman.
Paranorman, yeah. The boy in The Road. Ryan Quanten, I think that's how you pronounce his name.
That's right.
I, I saw him on True Blood. I think there was a horror movie he was in just before True Blood that I'm trying to remember what it was, but I'd seen him before. But there were a couple of actors in here that stood out to me, and not to say anything about the rest of the cast, but main character actors here, Deborah Mailman and Aaron Glenane.
Yeah.
Those guys are fantastic in this movie. I don't think I'd ever seen them in anything before.
Oh, I'm really glad to hear that. I mean, Deb Mailman is one of the best actors that we have working kind of like in Australia, you know. It's like really well, they're like best kept secret, but not to us though, right? Like to us, she's a superhero. she's one of those characters. She's one of those actors that my producer asked me at some point, you know, like for this character, Jackson, you know, if you could work with anybody that's around, like who would it be? And I instantly was like, Deb Mailman, but she'll never play a role like this for me. You know, like I was like, she'll never be in this movie. It's not, you know, and she jumped at it. Like she loved it. She just got it on a really kind of like kind of deep level. And I was super blessed. And she's amazing. You know, it's like literally like a career highlight for me to work with her. Aaron Glenane is an actor that, So Lisa Shaughnessy is my producer. We're also married. We've worked together for many, many years on lots of different things. We did a television series together amongst many other things. She made a movie a few years ago called Killing Ground, and Aaron Glenane was in that film. He was one of the leads in that film. And I came down to set to direct a little, just to help out a bit, do a bit of second unit and stuff. And I met him and I was watching him on the monitors on set. And I was like, who is that guy? Because I need to write a role for that guy. Like he is absolutely incredible. He's a superstar. He's actually now in the Snowpiercer TV series.
I knew I'd seen him somewhere else.
It was the same thing when we were about to shoot. It was quite late in the process because, you know, when these things get greenlit, sometimes they just go like really quickly, right? And then all of a sudden you've got to put a whole bunch of pieces together in a really short amount of time. Ironically, because you've been developing the script for a decade. So we were like literally, I think we were already down in Adelaide where we were filming, and I hadn't had this Richard character cast, and I needed someone really amazing. And you know, it's a big ask, and because he was shooting Snowpiercer, I think they shoot in Canada, if I'm not mistaken, maybe. And I called him, and I was just like, man, like. This is such a long shot because, you know, you're over there, we're over here. I know that you're filming and I need you in like 3 days, but I can't, you know, like I really, really desperately wanted him because it's such a pivotal character. You know, it's such at the center. His character is such at the center of the movie and at the center of Ethan's conflict and Ethan's wound. And it's a relationship as well. There's this sort of father-son story that's like really close to me as well. So I needed someone that was just absolutely incredible. And yeah, he flew down, I think got a couple of days off Snowpiercer, I think, and flew down like completely jet lagged and turned up at the first reading, I think like 6 hours after he'd landed from Canada. And I was like, man, you must be tired. Don't you want to go and sleep? And he's like, no, man, let's go. Let's do it.
It's not like he just had a couple lines either. I mean, you know, he's in a good portion and has a decent amount to do. That's awesome.
Oh, absolutely, man. I mean, he said when he landed, he said that he told me he picked up Neil deGrasse Tyson's book at the airport and read it like cover to cover in the plane on the way over. God. You know, and he landed, and I was just like, man, you know, it's really just a relationship story. All we got to work on is your relationship with your son. And we'll be good. And he just did such a phenomenal job.
But I mean, you look at that guy and you're just like, if I met him, I would be like, you're a scientist that built a time machine, aren't you? That's what you are. Because that's just kind of what he looks like.
Yeah. Well, yeah, totally, and I'm sure he gets this all the time, but he looks like Bradley Cooper is what he looks like.
Doesn't he? I agree. Yeah.
He looks a lot like him. I guess it's funny, the Deborah Mailman, if I hadn't known that she was such a legend in Australia, I think I could have surmised it because you give her there's a technique that filmmakers use where they introduce a character and you see them from behind first, and then you cut to, it's like, you know, you, it's like audience clap now, you know, this is the person that you do and everything. She was a revelation to me. I know that, like you said, out there, it's, it, you know, she's very well known, but I don't think she is here at all. If she is here, then I have completely missed her, but she's great.
Yeah, I've seen her. I've seen her in a couple of things, but I think they were both Australian series because I saw her the Wolf Creek series and then Mystery Road. Is that, I think that's what it's called. Yeah.
Yeah. She was in a movie called The Sapphires from a few years ago that was quite successful. I mean, I think she's done, maybe like probably 40 or 50 projects, I'd imagine. She's quite prolific over here. But yeah, you're probably right. She's probably more well-known.
I thought it was kind of funny that I didn't realize this until today, actually. I was, kind of going through the credits and everything, but Cody Smith McPhee's dad is in this movie as well.
Well, yeah, nice pickup.
at the beginning where he takes this guy's job, and that's the guy. He steals that guy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was really cool actually, because speak for Cody, but I think because Cody normally lives in LA, right. And his dad's over here. So they don't see each other. And it, much like myself and my dad, we don't live near each other. So it was kind of cool because Andy came to hang out with us on set a little bit, and it was a nice, I think it was a nice moment for Cody to be able to hang out with his dad a little bit. And so, it was really fun to kind of put them in a scene together. And I don't think they'd ever done that before, actually kind of act together. Cause Andy's an actor, obviously, like an accomplished actor in his own right. Mm-hmm. So it was cool. It was something that Cody really wanted to do. I was honored to be able to put it together for him.
Yeah. He got to talk back to his dad and not get like, get in trouble.
Exactly.
That's gotta be cool.
I'm wondering if while you were writing this, you may have just said, I'm going to do this time travel story and that's what I'm going to do. But it feels like you also have another movie in this thing. You could go through the whole thing about, O2 and how it's become currency in this world. And obviously it's causing the synthetic oxygen is causing some respiratory problems in some people. I could actually make a whole other movie out of that.
Absolutely. I think there's probably and that is something that's come up through the whole, not even just recently, but through the development process as well. There was various ideas at different points of how you can sort of split it off into, this idea for a television series. You could do a prequel. The invention of time travel, where there's some kind of like monikers that happened before this send Ethan White message. You could do a sequel, I think. There's some really interesting questions, I think, to be asked around the theme, I think. Yeah. And the world.
I was just thinking, man, this is, it really does have that kind of world. You could really explore that pretty deep, but.
Yeah. One thing I will say as well about that too, though, is that I think what was important for me is there was some, again, not without delving into what happens at the end or anything like that, but there were some questions that were asked through the development phase that, came to me about like, have you thought about ending the movie on more of a kind of like question rather than a, sort of don't quite resolve, And it was really important to me that we make a statement, that it's, I made the movie because I believe something. I wanted to put a message out there that, look, this is my point of view. This is the film's point of view about what this thing means. And I want to be clear about what that is. Like, I don't want to be like, here's a question and that's it, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you don't want to ram it down people's throat and have it be preachy. And ultimately you want it to be a conversation for the audience, but I didn't want to end it on that kind of like, look here, you have to watch the sequel to find out what happens.
Yeah, right.
No, that ending note is perfect. Like I think it is. I thought that was great.
I was actually going to ask you about the, like, I'm obviously not reveal what happens in the ending and everything, but I did want to talk about the score and then lead up to another question. First off, let's talk about score. I always think it's interesting when there's two composers credited How what was that like? How does that work? How did that come about?
So Ken Lample, he scored another one of my producer Lisa's films called The Furies. And that went really well. And I listened to the score. I was at the premiere of that movie and I heard the score and I was like, wow, this guy's like actually really incredible. And independently, he had asked Lisa, like, what are you doing next? And she said, well, Seth is making a movie. Maybe you guys should meet. And she told me this story that she sent him the script and he called her and said, I'm on a train on the way to Sydney right now. I have to meet with Seth. Kirsten. He and Kirsten both, right? They were together. Yeah. And so they came and we were in like pre phase. And it's just me hanging out with the HODs doing storyboards and working out stuff. So I met with those guys for lunch and they just connected, I think, just with the script, you know, like just on a really kind of like really strong level. And Ken studied under John Williams of all people.
Oh, really? Right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So he brings this kind of just like really strong breadth of kind of like classical knowledge in his construction of film scores, right? Like he's very classical, has incredible kind of like encyclopedia of knowledge, and also just has a lot of the same tastes. And Kirsten, similarly, they're a great pair because I think she's quite different. She's a concert pianist and brings a sort of, and she's, you know, she's from a very different part of the world to him, and she brings a really kind of beautiful feminine kind of aesthetic, and they worked really, really, really great together. You know, in terms of like the process, generally I would meet with Ken. Like, we have a screening theater set up in our house, and so where my office is, so he would come down. I'll tell you a little bit of backstory on this. So when we started working together, I'm very big on preparation and process, and I edit with temp score. I know some directors don't do that. I know some editors don't like directors to do it. Some composers don't like directors to do it. I do it because it's like, to me, it's like the tone of a movie is like, you know, the sum of its parts. And I want to try and find the tone of a scene. And I think sometimes, you know, the music is a really big part of that. It's hard because then a composer is like, oh, you know, you want me to match or make better this Hans Zimmer score that you put into this scene. I sent Ken and Kirsten this sort of 2-hour playlist of just like tonal references, right? It was basically like this tone Bible of the whole movie. And before we filmed, and then I'm driving this like a 16-hour drive from Sydney to Adelaide to film with Lisa, and we're in the car and I get this email from Kenny. He said, dude, I've sent you this we've scored an hour of music. This is before we've rolled on anything, right? I'm seeing this hour of music. Here's this playlist just to check out, just to see what you like, what you don't like, blah, blah, blah. You know, so I listened to that in the car and just put it on loop for like 8 hours while we were driving one day. And I was crying going, oh my God, here's the, you know, like starting to feel it's like the first pass of the movie is sort of coming to life, you know, all of the things. So the pitch I'd given him, the script, we talked about themes for the characters, the tone, we talked about instruments, we talked about all the references, you know. And so then I was able to take some of those tracks and play them for the actors on set. And I would say, here is the tone of this scene that we're performing right now. Right. And like another communication device. And that really helped to get them into character and into the world. And then when we got into the edit, we just essentially started from scratch and scored the actual movie then because we used this other stuff as reference. But yeah, so they essentially scored the movie twice. But it's like, you know, I think that sort of process, I mean, he's so enthusiastic, Kirsten as well, both of them are so enthusiastic. They just want to like work as much as they possibly can to get the best possible result. And so he was just pushing the whole time to start as early as possible so that we would end up with something that really spoke to the film in the strongest way possible, I think. Yeah.
It really does. Yeah, I didn't realize that they worked together. What I'm going to admit was a lazy IMDb lookup of them where, the stuff that came up for known for on both of them didn't match. And usually if there's like a partnership, you see the same movies just come up. But in this case, it didn't. So I just assumed that you had two different ones, and I didn't. You know, there are a lot of reasons why you would have two composers on a movie, but I was just kind of curious on this because I love this score in this. And what I was going to lead into is this is just a you know, a stroke your ego type of question, I guess. But not to spoil the movie, but when you have that score at the end of the movie and then the screen cuts to your name and it says written and directed by Seth Larney, what do you feel like when that happens?
I mean, you feel 10 feet tall, you know?
Yeah. Because
I think, yeah, I mean, look, you know, no, I mean, not really. I mean, it... Look, I think Ken's score, Ken talks about, there's this really cool EPK behind the scenes piece that we did with Ken where he talks about the process from his point of view. And one of the things he talks about that's really, really cool is that there's this main theme of the film that we constructed. But then as the film kind of builds, like we did a couple of things. We used the shepherd tone, which I totally ripped off from Chris Nolan, who, you know, obviously pioneered it from other places. But but we use a shepherd tone, and then with that builds over the whole of the last act. But then as the music starts to fold in on itself on that last passage, the score starts to sort of duplicate and repeat itself on multiple levels of division, right, of rhythm. Mm-hmm. So you have the score happening on four beats, you have it on four bars, you have it happening on eight, you have it happening on two, and those are folding over each other. And so that last kind of passage that you're hearing is actually the theme that's actually like looping it in itself on different timings, and it builds up into this kind of like orchestra. And so, I mean, it's cool, you know, like, I mean, talk about like seeing my name up there, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm moved every time I get. What I will say is that every time I get to that point in the film, I'm moved and I'm proud. You know, not about my name, but about the fact that I think that the film lands in the right place. Yeah,
right, totally. I didn't even, you know, I didn't even do anything on this film, and I was sitting there going, "Whoa, bam!" It just feels right when it has that it cuts to the, you know, the credits and everything. I don't know. It's a good statement at the end of this movie.
I always find with movies, right, like when you're editing a film, it's like you've got to end the film somewhere, and that like the picking of the beat or the moment where you're like, okay, that's it now, that's the last frame, like that's like you've earned it, you know, like the audience is in the right place, they're at the pinnacle of the experience right here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting and cool kind of like choice.
Obviously, you have some areas where you probably did a lot of green screen type of stuff, but did you shoot any location, any kind of locations at all?
Yeah, so, I mean, a couple of things. I think one, with this film in particular, because it's so sci-fi, we didn't have the benefit of really being able to find many locations that fit kind of what we were trying to say. So we had to build essentially everything from scratch. There's one building in the film that is, which is the foyer when they go into the Chronicorp foyer. That's a pre-existing foyer, but we dressed it. But every other space that has some kind of construction in it is built. There's no other location shooting for a building in the film. The only location shooting that we did, well, actually, it's not true. There's one tunnel that we filmed in that we dressed, and but it's just the forest stuff. Like we and it was surprisingly and sadly difficult to find a beautiful lush looking rainforest in Australia when we went to film, because
in the middle of the worst
historic drought that we've ever recorded in Australia when we went to film, you know. When I wrote this film, I was literally sitting in the rainforest that I grew up in thinking, well, I'm just going to shoot it here in this rainforest, like this is the most beautiful rainforest, and I want to tell a story about this rainforest that I grew up in. And then we did a couple of test shoots in this rainforest that I grew up in, and over the years, to bring a crew up there and see if the community could sustain a crew, and that there was enough resources and we could house them and how the shooting would go and stuff. So we shot a short film up there about 10 years ago. Then we shot a proof of concept trailer up there. But then when it came time to actually shoot the actual movie, it was dead. Like it was just brown and dry, and there was no rain. And it's like old growth rainforest that is this beautiful rainforest. And I was just thinking, wow, this is so horrible and ironic that, you know, I set a movie in this place because it's so beautiful, and then by the time you go to shoot it, it's not, you know, it doesn't look like that anymore. So we had to scour all of Australia and fly a crew like 1,500, like 1,000 miles away to find this small little pocket of forest that you see in the film.
Yeah, that is a beautiful area and everything. I felt like that was probably one of the only actual location shots that you got in the movie, but But it, I always like anytime I see something that pretty and everything, I'm like, where is that? I want to go there.
There is one shot. Now, I won't say what it is because it's a bit of a spoiler, but I'll say it's a big kind of helicopter shot that's on location. And that is actually shot in the town that I grew up in. Like, and it's the only shot that is shot in the town. And it was important to me to do it just because I really wanted to bring a piece of the film back to the community. Mm-hmm. And it's something that in my mind, I'd always wanted to go and shoot all of the location stuff there. And this was the next best thing I could do. So I kind of fought quite hard to at least shoot this one shot there. And it's actually the closing shot of the film is the one I'm talking about. So I'm glad that we got that in there, but even that shot, like I think we were worried that when we got up there, that whole shot would be full of smoke. And you can actually see a little bit of it. You can't really see it in the frame, but I think over the horizon of where we were filming, it was all on fire back there. Even when we filmed.
Oh wow! Oh my god!
But everything else we shot was studio in South Australia and Adelaide studios. It was all we took over the whole studio. They got two quite big good stages there, and we filled the whole studio out. Built the lab in their main stage. And then in the mm-hmm. second stage, we built the apartment, Ethan's apartment, and then we built this. There's another set. I won't say what it is, but and then there's a the office, Jackson's office, and then we also took over the car park and we built a big green screen kind of psych, like a big sort of 180-degree blue screen out there for some of the big sort of set extension stuff.
Right. It looks like you have some sort of, I guess at this point, every sci-fi movie has some Blade Runner influence in it. when you look at the cityscape, how in the world do you beat that cityscape? You know, it's like, it's the standard, right? Yeah. So, you know,
well, how do you, yeah, it's hard to get away from too, you know, like, I think when you like, you know, for me, I wanted to build this. I mean, as I was saying before, it all comes back to trying to reduce these things to story and how does it really serve the tone of the theme that you're trying to tell. But, you know, it's a dystopian, gritty, grimy, you know, sad kind of place. And Blade Runner just did that, you know, I think to perfection. So it's hard to get away from it.
Right. Jonathan, do you have any other questions?
Well, no, I was actually about to ask about the world building, but I think he kind of covered that in the last answer, so I think I'm good.
It always gets you into it, right? Like anytime you see that, to me, like anytime I see one of these cityscapes, I don't know what it is. It's like I want to know more about this city, even though it's ugly on the inside. It's like it's very attractive to me. Like what kind of movie we're about to get into?
Yeah, so you need to make 2068. Is what we're saying.
Something I can. Did we talk about color already? Because I can tell you something cool about the design of the city.
Oh, please do.
Yeah, please.
So one of the things that, as I was saying, I'm trying to like bring some of these choices back to, you know, it's like if you're designing a city, you know, what do you want the emotional impact for the audience to be? And also just, and really that just reduces down to the character arc and where you're trying to position the audience with the character, you know. As the character's going through these emotional impacts, the audience is going through the same emotional impacts. So an example of that with the design of the city is that because he moves between these two worlds, not only is there no trees in the 2067 world, that was like the starting point of the concept, but, you know, I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if there's not just no trees, but there's no green at all? So you know, hopefully you don't notice it kind of like intellectually. It's more just a feeling or a tone, right? But in all of the production design, and we could do it because we had to build everything. So it meant that we could make that choice on kind of every level, luckily. There's actually one moment. So everything is blue and red and brown. And that gives it a very specific, I think, kind of feeling, right? So there's a moment in the first act where Xanthi, his wife, he really symbolizes this kind of, you know, his motivation, this person that he needs to become. She's a botanical history teacher. I like the idea of botanical history, like because botany doesn't exist anymore. But she's an artist and she's painting with paint, and she mixes two colors of paint together to accidentally create green. And you don't see her do it, but then she's kind of play fighting with him, and she takes his paint and she kind of wipes it across his face. And again, it's just a feeling. It's not something that you kind of hopefully really notice, but it's quite in the frame. It's quite like, wow, like, what was that? Did something just happen? Because it's this color that just kind of cuts through all of the rest of the palette of everything that you've seen. And so she's like figuratively and literally giving him the gift of green, you know, of who he needs to become thematically through the story, right? So that's just like this small precursor of these kind of tonal shifts that we're sort of trying to do. And then of course, when you get to the end of the first act, and I mean, people, if you see the trailer, you'll see that he lands in green. There's a huge shift, a huge tonal shift that goes from the complete absence of green to only green, right? And so I think that the goal there, at least, is that you have this really heightened emotional impact, like this heightened emotional response to that shift in tone, you know, that makes those two worlds feel even more separate, if you like.
Right. Thank you so much for giving us that detail, because that's something that is, you know, a lot of times, you know, I think there are details a lot of times, and directors will be very forthcoming about it and say, you know, this only means something to me, but, you know, I'm glad that it's in this movie and everything. But anytime I hear something like that, I'm like, yeah, that gives me a little bit more appreciation for what you've done. You added little details like that. And next time I watch this movie, I will definitely keep an eye out for it, because that's great.
Oh, that's really cool, man. Well, I think, you know, I think that all those sorts of little things, you know, they're the sorts of things that you use that hopefully each of those things on their own, and they're not really of consequence to the audience, except that they kind of hopefully build up all together to end up in the experience, you know, end up in the feeling that you kind of have as you're walking out of the cinema. And, you know, you don't want them to be so obtuse or in the face that people go, oh, wow, I totally see what you did there. That was really on the nose. You know, you just want it to be like this texture, you know.
Right.
Hopefully building up into a bigger idea.
Right. I mean, it's not anything that I picked up on at all. But yeah, I mean, there are times that I have seen movies where they're like, oh, okay, all right, I see. You're doing a thing. I get it. We would like to thank Seth Larney for giving us his time and adding some insight to this movie. Mm-hmm. 2067 is coming out on October 2nd. Theaters, on demand, and digital. I know that both Jonathan and I really, really liked it. So you should try to find it wherever you can when October 2nd rolls around, which isn't too far around. It's like 2 days from this recording. So
2 days.
That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.